in an attempt to reach a diplomatic end to the war between Russia and Ukraine, Steve Witkoff was sent once again to talk with Vladimir Putin. The conversation was extensive. He had actually someone with him this time. He took the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and these talks lasted 5 long hours. And there was additional conversation with some of the other persons from the Russian side, Yuri Ushakov, whom we'll hear from here in a little bit. But the bottom line, after these talks were completed, is that no solutions were announced. No compromise was discussed. In fact, none of the terms of what the discussion was were real at all by either side. In fact, both sides said, we're not going to talk publicly about what happened, which is interesting because that's something that the Sergei Lavrov often says that they don't want to do diplomacy in the public because that doesn't work very well. It looks like we're following that right now, but it is alarming to many in the Western Europe, especially, that there was no outcome of this. Meanwhile, the Western side is doing really all it can, in my view, to undermine that peace, to undermine any movement towards peace, to get this war off the table. And in fact, what they are doing as we speak today, they're doing more than they can to support the war effort. And we'll talk about how crazy that is. And we couldn't have a better guest on to talk about some of these things today. We have back with us today Patrick Bob, German journalist and author, and also the host of a new podcast in Germany. What was the name of that one, Gary? If you could toss that up there. Gegen den Strom, right? Against the Stream. Good. Is that what it's called? In German?
Against the stream in English, and that means in German, gegen den Strom. Thank you very much for having me here.
Well, thanks very much for coming on today, because there's, you know, a lot's going on, and I you know, everybody's left to kind of read between the lines and try to interpret what the meaning of this is. Let me just ask kind of right off the top, what are your thoughts on the fact that there was at least as long, or if not the longest conversation that Witkoff has had with Putin? I think this was the sixth time he's met with him this year, 5 long hours, but nothing resolved afterwards. What does that tell you?
So that means that both sides are in good discussions, and the discussions, the negotiations are going on behind the scene. And from my point of view, this is a good sign. As far as I was informed, representatives of the People's Republic of China are well informed as well and involved in the talks. And that means that the three superpowers of the world are cutting deals and cutting claims. And this is a good sign as well. They are dividing the world under three. And there is a diplomatic saying which can be used for the Europeans. If you don't sit at the table, you will end up at the plate. And I think this is what's happening right now. The Americans, the Team Trump, did the right step in widening the scale of discussion topics. They introduced the question how to explore the natural resources of the Arctic region. They offered to reorganize a restart of the gas pipeline Nord Stream, and they wanted to discuss with the Russian side how to come in a situation where the frozen Russian assets in Europe, especially in Brussels, can be taken out and invested in cooperation projects of the Russian side and the American side. So a further good sign is that the Europeans are not at the table. So the warmongers are out of the show, and they are living their own madness right now. And this is a good sign, but the whole show and the negotiations are very difficult because the Trump team has to fight the deep state in America, the State Department, the Pentagon, and the administration. And this administration is full of warmongers, which are waiting for another president. And also the Europeans are trying to survive Mr. Trump and waiting for a new president. And the only way to survive for Mr. Zelensky and the right extremists around him is to go on deeper and deeper into this war in the hope that a new American administration will increase the pressure on the Russians. So it is very difficult to bring these three parties in the situation to compromise and to subordinate themselves under the ideas and the negotiation results of Putin and Trump. So both delegations are working very hard. And as far as I heard here in Berlin, our Chancellor Friedrich Merz is getting more silent. I think probably he got a phone call from Washington or from BlackRock, because BlackRock also wants to be involved in the investments of exploring the Arctic region. So the European warmongers will be imprisoned step by step, and this is a good sign.
Well, it's just sad that those entities exist and that there's almost more complications on the Western side and within the Western house than there is between the West and the Russian side. But that's the reality that we have. I want to look at one of the few things that the Russians did say following this meeting here. As you pointed out, there was a whole host of things that were discussed. It wasn't just about the Russia-Ukraine war. But on that point, Yuri Ushakov had a press briefing afterwards when he at least talked categorically about what was and what wasn't agreed to.
We could agree on some things, and the president confirmed this to his interlocutors. Others provoked criticism, and the president also did not hide our critical, even negative, attitude toward a number of proposals. But the main thing is that we had a very useful discussion. And most importantly, I would like to emphasize once again that the parties declared their readiness to continue working together to achieve a peaceful, long-term settlement in Ukraine.
Now, I would imagine that some of the things that he said they found unacceptable were, number one, that not only would there not be demilitarization, but a force of this proposed up to 600 or 800,000 for the Ukraine side, that Russian assets would be used to rebuild Ukraine, and that there would be U.S. security guarantees as part of this, and that Russia would have to give up their claim on part of Kherson and Zaporizhia Oblast. Do you see any additional things that the Russians may have objected to?
Yes, you are completely right. The first point is the level of Ukrainian troops, 600,000 to 800,000, following these proposals. We had negotiations in Istanbul in spring 2022, and both sides, the Russian side and the Ukraine side, agreed on a number of troops of 250,000. So a level of 600,000 or more means NATO troops will come into Ukraine. And this is a complete no-go for the Russian side. It is also a complete no-go for the Russian side to negotiate about the frozen assets being invested in European-directed investments in Ukraine. It's impossible. So the reaction of the Russian side will be the completely freezing of foreign assets in Russia itself. And the next point that is, we have to see that the Russians cannot give up the occupied regions. These regions are now part of the Russian Federation. And by the Russian constitution, no president is allowed to give those regions away. So these regions are not under discussion. And I think President Putin explained President Trump in Anchorage, Alaska, that Russia is fighting a war of decision. They cannot go back. They don't want foreign troops directly in their face. It's the same situation the Americans had during the Cuban crisis in the early 60s. And peace can only be found by meeting the Russian demands. And that means a neutral Ukraine out of the NATO. And the secondly, a shelter, more shelter of the Russian population in eastern Ukraine. That is very clear. And in the there is a third point, which is not in the discussion field. That means, in the eyes of the Russians, the denazification of the whole Ukraine as a whole. So that means regime change in Kiev. And so the American side has to bring Zelensky in a position to step down, or Zelensky will be brought out of his office with the feet first. That's the problem. So, and we need a regime change in Kiev to open a field for discussions.
Well, that certainly is diametrically opposed to what the Europeans want. And that's one of the things you mentioned at the outset of this, and I kind of wanted to go down the road here. But before I do, because there's a kind of a confluence between the two sides, really, within the Western side, and that is Marco Rubio. You mentioned a minute ago that he's kind of on the outs, and there's an interesting dynamic playing out right now. There is a NATO foreign ministers meeting in Europe. I think it's right now. I think it's going on even as we speak. And America's foreign minister, Secretary of State Marco Rubio, is not there. That's curious on one point. But here's something he said last night on American television, trying to make this, put lipstick on a pig, as we say in the U.S., trying to make this really bad military situation look better.
At some point in this war, Russia controlled substantially more territory in Ukraine than they do now. The Ukrainians, if you look at what that map looked like in March or April after the invasion, or May, 3 months after the invasion, and what it looks like now, the Ukrainians have pushed the Russians way back from where they were. So they've already achieved tremendous things because of their bravery, their courage, and how hard they have fought. But there's also the reality. This has now become a war of attrition. And sadly, the Russians have shown their willingness to sacrifice 7,000 soldiers a week.
Crazy.
In an effort to achieve this. Putin a couple weeks ago said, it may take long. We are going to achieve our objectives. It may cost more and take longer than we wanted to, but we will get it done. And so I actually think that's their mentality. And what we're trying to see, is it possible to end the war in a way that protects Ukraine's future?
And how do you see that comment? Because on the one hand, he openly and correctly cites what Putin has just said here just a couple of days ago. But then he tries to make it sound like, but no, the Ukraine side has really done a lot when you look all the way back to 2022. But militarily, what he doesn't talk about between that time in 2022 and today is the loss of potentially, depending on who you want to believe, but potentially a million Ukraine soldiers that were alive at the beginning of that and aren't now. So the fabric of the Ukraine side is far less than what the territory is. How do you see it?
I think Marco Rubio, the foreign secretary, is completely right. He didn't show up at the summit of NATO, and this is a clear message. It doesn't matter what you want to say to me. So the Americans are going their way, and Marco Rubio is right. According to a leak of the Ukrainian general staff, more than 1.7 million soldiers are dead or missed on the Ukraine side. Yesterday, the Russian troops occupied Pokrovsk completely. And that means the regions far west of Pokrovsk, this is just black earth, no woods, no forests. So there is no fortification, no fortress of the Ukrainian side over there. That means the Ukrainian have to make a choice between losing a lot of territory right now and accepting the Russian conditions, or going on with the war and losing much more. And probably they are risking that the Ukraine state will be destroyed. Keep in mind that the Ukrainians, I think with the help of the British, attacked neutral tank ships, tank vessels in the Black Sea. And the result was that there is a discussion in the Russian Federation that probably it would be better for the Russian side to occupy Odessa as well and to cut the Ukrainians away from the Black Sea to make a safe shipping, to make sure that the ships can reach Russian harbors. And so the Europeans are dreaming. They are not living in the sphere of reality. They are living in their own dreams like drug heads. They are imprisoned by their own narratives and their own propaganda. And this is absolutely the wrong way. It's the way of self-destruction of Europe. So Rubio is completely right.
Well, and then let's see some of his interlocutors on the Western side. And let's start with Ursula von der Leyen, whom you have some knowledge of, because what she said earlier today, is that the only language Vladimir Putin understands is pressure.
As from the beginning, Ukraine can rely on the fact that Europe will remain the strongest and most steadfast partner. We all know that we can never match the sacrifice of the Ukrainian people, but what we can match is their stamina, their resolve, their staying power, and we can equip them with the means to defend themselves and to lead peace negotiations from a position of strength. And since pressure is the only language the Kremlin responds to, we can also dial it up. We have to increase the costs of war for Putin's aggression, and today's proposal gives us the means to do this.
I think that just categorically speaking, you can say that she is technically correct, is that Russia understands pressure, but you can say that about literally any belligerent in any conflict ever. And what she seems to be unaware of, and I'd like your view on this, is that the paucity of the strength on their side, on our side, on the Western side, to put that pressure, enough pressure on Russia that would compel them to change policies. And then when she says, we want to go into this negotiations, although we're in it, I don't know what she means by go into it, from a position of strength. I don't see any strength that even exists. What do you see?
Well, look into her face. I see a mixture of desperation and moral hazard. Well, the Europeans don't have the power to fight the Russian Federation. They could send an expedition corps of, let me say, 50,000 or 60,000 soldiers, and such a corps or a small army will be destroyed by hypersonic missiles in a week or two. So they have no power. On the other hand, moral hazard, because the Europeans, in person of Johnson, the Prime Minister of the UK, stopped the negotiations in the beginning in spring, in March 2022. So this turns around the responsibility for many thousands Ukrainian dead soldiers. So the Europeans and the Americans as well refused to stop the war in the very beginning. So, and this is moral hazard and desperation, because they cannot stop the negotiation process. They are not involved anymore.
And somebody who's also ironically not involved anymore is the Ukraine side. And kind of in lockstep with what Ursula von der Leyen was saying, you had Volodymyr Zelensky, who also went out and said, and this is a kind of a strange statement on a number of fronts here, but pay attention to what he says about, in light of all of these scandals that are just inflamed inside of the Ukraine leadership right now, about no one should profit from war.
War should not become a profitable business so that others would not want to repeat such actions. That is why we take principled positions on sanctions, on accountability for war crimes, on the legal status of our territories currently occupied by Russian forces, on Russian assets, and on the obligation of reconstruction. The aggressor must pay for the aggression. The stronger the world's united stance on these points, the more secure and lasting peace will be.
Yes, this is just propaganda in my eyes. It is interesting that Zelensky said nobody should profit from war. But he is one of the greatest war profiteers. According to military experts, 1/5 to 1/3 of all weapons deliveries to Ukraine are shipped to other places in the world. They don't come to the front line. They are reaching other conflict regions of the world. And the whole Ukrainian oligarchy is profiteering from this war. Also Zelensky privately and his companions. So this is a complete corrupt regime. It's a criminal regime. It's a dictatorship, a military dictatorship. And I know people in Kiev who told me, I am waiting for the Russians to come to get freed from this dictatorship of Zelensky. And for Zelensky, this is only a matter of survival. The only way to survive is to go on with the war. If Zelensky would agree to stop the war, he will be killed by his own security personnel, which is recruited by Galician right-wingers and fascists. And the problem will be in the whole peace process, how to calm down these Ukrainian fascists. They are completely under weapons and they want to fight against Russia. And they are very ideological and they will not stop fighting. That's the main point. So I think the only way to stop the fighting is to bring the whole regions, eastern and northern of the Dnieper River, into the Russian hands, because the Dnieper is a natural border. This is the only way to stop the fighting. And we are far away from this. But if it is not possible to cut a deal right now, the Russian army will go on occupying territories more and more west. So this is the step. And so Zelensky is getting weaker and weaker. He is in a very dangerous position because his only personal hope can be that American special forces will help him to come into another country. This is the only hope of survival for Zelensky. I can't hear you.
Well, there's certainly no hope. There's certainly no hope that Zelensky's troops can turn things around on the battlefield. And that was really underscored about 36 hours ago by the chief of staff of the Russian army, General Gerasimov, when he laid out exactly for Putin how things are progressing on the front lines.
Comrade Supreme Commander-in-Chief, in accordance with the plan of the special military operation, the troops of the joint group are conducting an offensive along a broad front. The command of the Ukrainian armed forces continues unsuccessful attempts to unblock its encircled groups in the Kupiansk and Krasnormaysk directions and is seeking to halt our advance in the Krasnolimansk, Severodonetsk, Dnipropetrovsk, and Zaporizhia directions. Force Group North completed the liberation of the city of Vyvchansk today. Furthermore, according to the General Staff's plan, retaliatory massive strikes against Ukrainian military industrial facilities and the energy infrastructure that supports their operation are continuing. Supreme Commander-in-Chief, the formations and military units of the Joint Group of Forces will continue to launch active offensive operations with the goal of completely liberating Donbass.
So from an independent position, I guess, if you will, you just talked about how Zelensky was talking about things, and you say, well, that's just pure propaganda. But let's look at that Russian side from that same lens and assess it. Is what Gerasimov was saying just for public consumption? Obviously, the cameras are rolling, so the intent is for people to hear that. But is that just words, or are the words matched with deeds on the ground?
I think Gerasimov is completely right. He is telling the truth. So the Russian troops are advancing. I already told that Pokrovsk, Krasnoarmeysk in the Russian version, is in Russian hands. And this is a very important crossing of railways and streets. And on the whole front line, at a large scale, the Russian troops are advancing. And this means the Ukrainians have only the choice between stopping the war now and cutting a peace deal and agreeing to the American proposals, or to get into a much worse situation. And so the war will go on. The Russian side will not agree to a ceasefire because they have advantages on the battlefield. And the European side is discussing just about propaganda lies. That's the position.
And so that was what Gerasimov was saying to Putin. Putin had an interesting comment. I think it was yesterday when he was talking about the, at that time, the Witkoff meeting before it happened, that Steve Witkoff was on his way over there. And he was saying that what they had seen so far was going back to, I think it was the Anchorage meeting where Putin and Trump personally spoke together, and what Putin apparently thought an agreement, that they had an understanding of where the conditions were, had kind of gone into a pause. But then he says, you know, this 28-point peace plan that that Trump released, he said from his perspective, it's like the European side seems to be trying to sabotage that so that there won't be a peace. Here's how he put it.
Они же на стороне войны. И даже тогда, когда они пытаются якобы внести какие-то изменения в предложение Трампа, мы же это отчетливо видим. Все эти изменения направлены только на одно, на то, чтобы вообще заблокировать весь этот мирный процесс, выдвинуть такие требования, которые для России являются абсолютно неприемлемыми, они это понимают, и тем самым свалить потом на Россию сворачивание этого мирного процесса. Вот в чем их цель, мы это отчетливо видим.
So for anybody who may not have been able to read those words, I know they're pretty small on the screen there, but he's saying is this peace plan, that the changes that the Europeans were making in the negotiations between the U.S. and Europe seemed to be designed to undermine the process by inserting things that they knew that Russia, that their red lines that they wouldn't agree to. And he says, we see this clearly. Is that just Putin putting the spin on things, or does he have a point about what the Europeans are trying to do?
I think Putin is right. The Europeans have two goals. They want to go on with this war, and they want to bring in NATO troops into Ukraine, and they want to have the Americans in this war. And this is completely acceptable for both sides, the Americans and the Russians as well. But on the European side, they are losing ground, and they clearly don't play any role in this negotiation process. And Putin says clearly they cannot destroy the peace process right now. They have not the power to do so. And he is he's showing what the Europeans are intending to do. From my side, this is the wrong way. The Europeans don't play any matter right now. They brought themselves into this situation by completely subordinating themselves under the interests of the United States. But the interests of the United States changed. The interests of the hegemon changed. The Biden government tried to weaken Russia by fighting a war in Ukraine against Russia. And the Trump government makes very clear that it wants to cut a deal with Russia to fight the Chinese. And this is a different approach. And the Europeans cannot understand that. They could not understand that because they are waiting for another government in the United States. And the second point is the political survival of the European functional elites depends on the continuation of the war because they brought their own countries in a dead-end street. Economically, they are close to bankruptcy and they need the Russian assets. And when the bill will be shown to the European people, those European elites will be kicked in the garbage can of history.
So what would be the result economically if President Trump and his team finally say, okay, you know what, I'm tired of trying to get you guys on board. I'm trying to find a happy medium that everybody can agree to. I'm just going to agree to what I can agree to with Russia for our own interests, our own long-term interests, and we'll agree to whatever here. You guys are on your own. If you want to keep fighting this war, if you want to keep supporting this, have at it, but you're going to do it completely without us. What would happen in that case within Europe?
For the Europeans, means the whole negotiation process. They are completely under American control, especially in a situation when American companies and Russian companies are reorganizing the gas delivery via Nord Stream so they can control the European gas supply. And the second point is economic decline. They don't play any economic role anymore in the future. And European will be a row of failing states in the end of the show, a row of failing states. They will getting poorer and poorer. And I expect a lot of political crisis situations in Europe, demonstrations, protests of the people, and all that, probably beginning in Ireland. I don't know. And there was the German government. Yeah.
Sorry, there was some comment this morning from Mark Rutte, from the NATO Secretary General, that they want to try and keep Ukraine afloat through the year 2026 with an infusion of $90 billion, which subsequently Ursula von der Leyen also added was probably going to be funded by more debt. How is that going to work out economically? Forget about the negotiations for a second and whether this goes to an end, but how can they economically facilitate adding yet more debt? Will that not cause negative implications for the economy across the board?
Yes, it's only by more debts in the hope that the European side can get more collateral in the on Ukraine soil. But this is impossible. It is betting on the future. And it's a kind of Russian roulette. So it's just rhetoric, just telling stories.
So let's say that they agree to this and they actually implement this new debt and they come up with this $90 billion based on a future hope of some kind of assets. But then Gerasimov's comments and Putin's statements turn out to be how it actually plays out, and Russia wins the war. Ergo, they don't have access to any of those hoped-for assets, and now they're just saddled with this big old debt and a country that is now collapsed. What impact is that going to have on the economy of Europe?
They are destroying their own economies by more debts. That's clear for me. But I have to say, I'm representing a minority position. And the politicians of Germany and France and the UK are trying to lie to their own people on this. And the majority is believing these lies. That's the problem. It's just propaganda. And those politicians know they are coming to an end and they will be held responsible for that, what they have done in Ukraine, about 2 million death people. And I think partly these politicians have to fear criminal prosecution.
Wow, that's a pretty strong statement. Let's look at Germany in particular here on the military aspect, because there's also been information out here in recent days that Germany wants to become the new military power on the continent, and they want to increase their military size. They want to bring back a draft. They want to make plans in a certain sense for a future conflict with Russia. What can you tell us about what the Germans are actually doing militarily?
So Germany's economy is in full decline, and the politicians have the strategy to set their hopes into the military-industrial complex to save a lot of jobs for the near future. But in the end, these are consumptive investments. That doesn't help the country. We need new schools. We need new streets. We have to invest in infrastructure, in education and all that. And so this is the wrong way from my side. It helps for some years, but it shows that every war is not only a war against the foreign enemy. Every war is also a class war to intensify the exploitation of the middle class. And what we see right now in Germany is a kind of exploitation of the middle class for transferring the financial resources to the military-industrial complex in Europe, but especially in the United States. That's the process.
Well, so let me ask you something. I spent 6 years living in Germany when I was during my military career, to several different times, and I stayed there for several different durations as a military member in the U.S. And I remember pretty distinctly that there was a version of pacifism that was in the German mentality as a result of World War II, et cetera. And now then to say that, our better question here, what is now the attitude of the German general population, if you can characterize it like that, especially of the rising population, the young groups who would have to be able to be recruited into the military or would have to be forced to go into the military to be able to bring those numbers up? Will the population in Germany support that now without an overt, yes, this is a big threat to your national security?
I personally was a member of the peace movement in Germany in the early 80s, in the last century. And it is difficult for me to understand that most Germans are sleeping into the abyss, especially the younger ones. I think it's a question of digitalization, a question of propaganda, and it is a question of psychology. The first point is digitalization. They are taking computer games and Hollywood movies for the real war. They think a war looks like it is shown in Hollywood movies or in computer games. And I've seen three wars. I can tell you this is completely wrong. They never saw dead bodies. And they cannot imagine what war looks like. And when they will know this, it will be too late. The second point is a question of psychology. My parents and grandparents were educated as Nazis, completely. And the way of educating the daughters and sons was like in Nazi times. Hmm. And I knew exactly that I have to be against this. And so I fought against parental authorities and against state authorities as well. I was always a dissident. I was always in the opposition. But today's generation of fathers and mothers are best friends to their children. So the conflict between the generation is not fought anymore. And this is an anti-democratic behavior, because in democracy you always have to limit the power of authorities. So that means you have to bring authorities always under control. And you have to be careful and skeptical against authorities. And the younger generation I see agrees to authorities and believe in authorities. And they will learn that this is a mistake. And both sides are playing a role. And then we know the power of propaganda. According to official information, 10 years ago, the Pentagon employed 27,000 people in the PR area. They were responsible for public relations, and they had a budget, a yearly budget of $5 billion. And the power of propaganda, of NATO propaganda, is very strong. And so NATO has a lot of officers for cognitive warfare. That does not mean to change the content of thinking. That means to change the way of thinking. And NATO wants to bring, like a carpet, ressentiments, emotions before, in front of rational thinking. And this is what NATO does. They want to boost Russophobia, racism, and this way of thinking. And this makes impossible for many people to get a clear brain and to think in a clear way. That's the problem.
And how does AfD, Alternative für Deutschland, how does that fit into this? Because it would seem that there's at least an alternative out there that is scratching out some kind of success within all of this conflict that's going on.
Let me begin on the other side. The Bündnis Sarah Wagenknecht, BSW, the lefties, committed suicide by joining two governments on the federal level in Thüringen and Brandenburg. So the only alternative for many people, especially in Eastern Germany, is the AfD, Alternative for Germany. So in AfD, you have two wings. One wing is seeking a peace with Russia and an understanding with Russia. And then you have a transatlantic wing who wants to subordinate the AfD under the interests of the United States for bringing the AfD into the next government. And I expect that the transatlantic wing will be successful.
And so how would that term, right now they're in the minority, obviously, in the event that the majority and the powers that be keep moving in this direction of anti-Russianism, et cetera, to keep that agenda up, to keep the, you know, build up military power. But then there is an economic either crisis or even outright collapse, apparently both of which are potentially possible for the entire Western world, not just Germany. But if that starts happening now, then all of these claims that the powers that be cannot provide for the basic economic health of the country, will that cause people to maybe go more on to reject some of those thoughts, or might it have the opposite effect to where it makes people say, no, they're the ones that are responsible for it, and we have to double down on these bad policies? How do you see that playing out?
Yeah, my dystopia is that many people will vote for the AfD in the next time. The AfD will be transatlantically transformed and join the next federal government, and then things will go on as they were under transatlantic American control. And so people are frustrated and will do nothing. That's my expectation for Germany.
So there's no scenario whereby Germany just asserts its own independent pro-German view and says, okay, I'm not so much an Atlanticist or an American version, but just, you know, I'm Germany first, so to speak.
It would be good to say Germany first, and I think politicians should represent the interests of their own country. But this
political it used to be normal, but
it is absolutely not normal in Germany. So our political elite is representing the interests of the United States. They try to represent the interests of the United States for bringing themselves in a position that the hegemon will help them by managing their career. So that's the idea of German elites. They don't represent the German people, and they don't represent the Germany of the interests of the nation. That's the problem we have right now. So I think we need other elites. We need a cultural change in academic elites, in economic elites, in culture, in art elites, and in media elites as well, and in in the politicians' elites. So we need, and this is a process of 20 years. So I think the next generation is lost.
Well, that's a pretty dire outcome, but one that the evidence implies is justified. And one thing that works against that is something that concerns me a lot. So we just got through talking about Germany's trying to build up its military. They're pointing to the claimed threat of Russia. But then you also have the UK building up their military. You have France building up its military, the Baltics, Poland, all of them all looking to the east and saying that, you know, Russia is a threat, and many other in NATO. You had an Italian admiral just a couple of days ago saying that we have to get more aggressive against Russia. All of these pretty provocative and aggressive statements from a number of West European nations toward Russia has an impact. And Vladimir Putin spoke on that just a couple of days ago and said, hey, if you guys want war, we'll give it to you.
I've said that 100 times. We have no plans of fighting against Europe. But if Europe wants to fight and they start this fight, then we are ready right now. There is no doubt about this. But the only question is, if Europe starts the war, unleashes this war, because that's not Ukraine. With Ukraine, we use some surgical means. We are trying to be really careful. Because you understand why. This is not a war in the direct sense of the word. And Europe, all of a sudden, wants to start a war. And if it does start a war, then very rapidly there might be a situation where we have no one to negotiate with.
So what do you make of that? Because on the one hand, if you just look at the balance of power in the actual military, you mentioned it a second ago. You said you probably could be lucky if you got a small core of all of the best of European armies together, which would be maybe 50,000 effective combat troops, which is nothing compared to the 1.5 million total active troops that the Russians have, which are combat experienced, and they have the defense industrial base. So if you just look at that, it would be out of all proportion to any kind of, it wouldn't be a fair fight. But I can also see a position to where those in the European side who were making these statements will look to this exact soundbite that I just played and say, aha, this proves it. See, he's actually getting ready for war with us and oblivious to the antecedent that he had. That. How do you see that playing out? And do you fear that there may be eventually a conventional clash between the East and the West?
Let me say first that Russia has no reason to attack Europe. This is a a country with a population of 155,000 people, in the largest country on Earth. So they need more humans, more Russians in his own country. And the second point is, the Russians have everything what they need in their own country. They don't have to conquer other territories. They have everything, every minerals, everything. So there is no reason to attack Europe. And this is something Putin made very clear several times. But he also told the journalists, if Russia wants to have a war, if Europe wants to have a war with Russia, in a few days we will have nobody to negotiate with. And that means the Russian Federation would fight another war as it did in Ukraine. In Ukraine, the Russians are fighting a very careful war. So everybody count is shit. That's very clear. Every human being is important. But the Russians are careful in afflicting civilians. We have a number of between 20,000 and 30,000 killed civilians in the Ukraine war. Compare this with other conflict areas and wars. This is not really much. And Putin made very clear, in a war against Europe, this would escalate very soon to a nuclear war. And there will be no Central Europe anymore to negotiate with. That's very clear. So this is a warning, a clear warning, that the Russian Federation will use nuclear weapons as soon as possible in a war against Europe.
And do you think that message is getting through? Because it doesn't seem to be, because the European side seems to be ramping up, not ramping back its belligerent conversations.
I think this is a serious warning. Political advisors in Moscow, like Professor Sergei Karaganov, told the press in an interview, if European politicians forgot how the way to hell looks like, we can show you that. And that's a clear warning. And this warning is not be heard in Western Europe. And so what I see in the politicians, in the group of politicians in Western Europe, is a kind of apocalyptic blindness. They don't see the risks because they don't want to see the risks they are in.
And what do you say against the counter to that from the, I guess you can call it the elite perspective here, is that, well, if we did what you guys are suggesting and just said, all right, we're just going to get this war off the table and basically let Russia have everything, and that will reward their aggression and all this, and it will just invite future war. I mean, it's the classic Munich 1938 all over again, except now then for the Western Europe. What do you say to that?
I would say we just reached the level of 19... sanction packages against Russia with no result, and implementing always the same method and the same measures while waiting for other results. From my point of view, this is the definition of mental madness. And we are led by mental mad people in Europe.
Well, that's not very encouraging, but as we say on this channel here, we are unintimidated and uncompromised to bring the truth, no matter what it is, because if you don't first of all acknowledge the truth and expose it, then you don't have a chance to actually fix it. And what I'm hoping is that, because now this is all trends, This is all things moving in a bad direction, but at least with the exposure of the truth and actions like yours and your podcast and the people that you're talking to, we have a shot at educating people and moving them back in a direction so that they see the failure of 19 consecutive sanctions package, and they're trying to do a 20th that will almost certainly fail the same way the first 19 did, et cetera, that people will finally go, wait, this makes no sense at all. That's our hope anyway. And so we appreciate people like you coming on and doing the best that you can to educate people about the realities. So thank you very much for coming on today.
Thank you for having me here.
Always a pleasure. And we appreciate you guys too. Join us back in about 1 hour from now. We're going to have the ever famous and popular Larry the Shirt Johnson back on the show, former CIA analyst. He's always got some great views and he's got some great information to pass along about some of the things on the Russian side, because he has some connections up there that we don't have. You'll look forward to seeing that at 1 o'clock on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.